It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a student who met with UW System President Ray Cross to talk about the state of diversity and inclusion at the UW.
First, a new report out from the American Lung Association finds some mixed news when it comes to the state of tobacco control in Wisconsin. While the state gets high marks when it comes to tobacco taxes and smoke-free air, Wisconsin gets failing grades when it came to tobacco prevention and cessation funding, as well as access to cessation services.
In addition, the report finds a high level of youth use of tobacco products other than cigarettes. And health experts say that threatens to undermine the overall progress in the fight against tobacco-caused death and disease.
Here with us now to talk more about the state of tobacco use in 2016 in Wisconsin is Donna Wininski, Director of Tobacco Control and Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Donna, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So overall, how would you say Wisconsin is doing when it comes to controlling the use of cigarettes and tobacco products?
Well, I think you summed it up pretty well in your introduction. We're doing very well on a couple of fronts. We have one of the strongest smoke-free air laws. It protects anybody in any workplace, and when we passed our law, we actually extended it to the next level and included hotels and accommodations like that. So that's a very good law. We do have a relatively high cigarette tax. So when I say relatively, I mean in terms of compared to other states, which is why we get a B grade for that. And the reason that a high cigarette tax is important is because it raises the price of cigarettes. And especially with kids, we find that they tend to be price sensitive. And if they cost too much, they may think twice about whether they want to buy them or not. In the other two areas, however, we are receiving failing grades, and those are in the amount that we invest in tobacco prevention and cessation programs, things to prevent the next generation of kids from smoking and things to help the current population of smokers to be successful in their quit attempts. It can be very difficult, and it often takes several attempts to quit smoking, and we have to make sure those resources are there for people to be successful.
Has this been a change from the past, this letter F?
Those have been pretty consistently F grades, and they are pretty much linked to the funding levels that are attached to them. The Centers for Disease Control recommends that states spend somewhere in the ballpark of $10 to $11 per smoker to adequately provide them with the resources that they need to quit. Our rate here in Wisconsin is somewhere around $1 or $2, so you can see it's very, very low in terms of what we should be spending. And the problem with that is that they are not able to call the quit line as often as they need to. The quit line is the main free resource here in Wisconsin, and they can only really provide one phone call. They can still provide the 2 weeks of nicotine replacement coverage. But there's just a lot that they can't do. In fact, the quit line doesn't advertise very often simply because they can't handle the volume of calls.
So what do you ascribe that control, that funding shortfall to? Is it to do with the state budget, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the state budget. Many years ago, we did still have revenues coming in from the state, from the tobacco settlement, and under Governor McCallum, those revenues were cut off because they were securitized to fill a one-time budget gap. So every 2 years, we have to go back to the state legislature and protect the funding and ask for them to renew the program and just hang on to the funding that we do have. The program has been cut several times over the last few years, and we just are at the point where we're trying to maintain what we have. There is a certain amount of belief within some members of the legislature that the job is done, that we have a good, strong smoke-free air law now, that cigarette smoking rates are going down, and that attention really needs to be directed to other more pressing needs. And that's where our report comes to, because cigarette smoking rates are down. But what is alarming is it's almost like playing whack-a-mole here in Wisconsin, that as fast as we get a handle on one particular product, the tobacco industry comes up with something equally as deadly, and we're seeing the kids gravitate to those products.
Let's talk more about that right now as we talk with Donna Wininski, Director of Tobacco Control and Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about how the state of tobacco usage is doing in 2016 here in Wisconsin. And Donna, you said game of whack-a-mole here, that maybe cigarettes are in decline, but alternative things like e-cigarettes are spiking up. What's going on there?
E-cigarettes and little cigars. Little cigars are a big problem because they're virtually identical to cigarettes. They're about the same size, have about the same amount of tobacco. The only difference is that they're wrapped in a slightly different kind of paper that allows them to qualify as cigars instead of cigarettes. So all of the federal regulations about selling them by clerks, that they have to be behind the counter, that apply to cigarettes, don't apply to those products. There are federal regulations against flavoring cigarettes. Those don't apply to little cigars. And the cigarette tax in Wisconsin is considerably higher than the tax on cigars. So you really have this almost this three-way bit of bad news. They're lower priced. They come in candy and fruit flavors, chocolate, strawberry, grape-flavored cigars. They're less expensive. They're more easily accessible because they don't have to be behind the counter. And while we see the cigarette smoking rates go down, what we've actually seen is rates of those types of products go up accordingly. In fact, by now, they're almost double what cigarette smoking rates are.
There isn't absolute consensus about the health dangers or safety of things like e-cigarettes, hookahs. I don't know about little cigars, but I know we've talked a lot about e-cigarettes on this program. And not everybody agrees that these are harmful. So are you equating, you're obviously looking at these as something that is sort of a danger. Are you at the point where you're looking at an e-cigarette kind of like a cigarette?
Well, e-cigarettes are in a little bit more of a category by themselves just because they don't burn tobacco. Certainly, little cigars and hookah are just as dangerous as smoking cigarettes, and again, for a lot of the same reasons that I've outlined. But even e-cigarettes, the argument that we hear quite often is, well, they're safer than smoking cigarettes. And if you think about it, that's really a pretty low bar to set because pretty much anything is safer than smoking a cigarette. What we do know, we don't have long-term health impacts, but we do have some more short-term health impacts. We do have scientific research showing that there are some pretty nasty chemicals in the flavorings of e-cigarettes. One is called diacetyl. The other is a very long chemical name, and our own Marquette University here in Wisconsin did a study of six of the most common e-cigarette flavorings and found high levels of these chemicals that we do know cause irreparable lung damage. So it is more than just the water vapor that the e-cigarette industry wants you to believe.
Are you also looking at e-cigarettes as sort of a gateway to regular cigarettes, or are you just worried about them as a problem, a potential health risk in and of themselves?
Yeah, it's both, because that's actually some of the more recent research we've seen as well, too, that kids who have never touched a regular cigarette, kids who have never even considered touching a regular cigarette because they have been indoctrinated into the dangers of that, they are experimenting with e-cigarettes because they have kind of bought into that industry rhetoric that they're safer. They're just nothing more than water vapor. So we do see a lot of kids that are starting to use those, and they can be gateway drugs to other types of tobacco products. We are starting to see some research going out on that. And even the people who claim that e-cigarettes have helped them quit smoking, we find that just as often they may be cutting back, but they aren't necessarily quitting entirely. And what's happening more often than not is that they're dual using. They're smoking cigarettes some of the time, but then they're using e-cigarettes other times where smoking regular cigarettes isn't allowed. So they're still getting the nicotine, they're still getting the tars and all of the other toxins that are in cigarettes, they're still getting the chemicals that are in the flavorings of the e-cigarettes, maybe in varying quantities.
So the point of a report like this is to raise awareness of successes and challenge areas. What is the takeaway here for policymakers?
Well, the takeaway for policymakers is that let's not rest on the laurels. We have made some remarkable progress on the tobacco control front, and the numbers bear it out. When you look at only about 10% of high schoolers are now smoking regular cigarettes compared with over 30% a decade ago, that's unquestionably good news. And if that's where it ended, I think we would be a lot happier than we are now. But when you look at some of these new products that have come out only over the past 5 or at the most 10 years, and how the kids are really gravitating towards them, clearly we need to be doing more towards changing some of the policies, at least those that make them so accessible, price accessible, accessible in terms of just being able to walk into a convenience store and seeing these pretty brightly packaged things lined up next to the candy racks, for example. I mean, we've come a long way with cigarettes, and now we need to play a little catch-up with some of these other products.
Donna, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for the time.
That was Donna Wininski, Director of Tobacco Control and Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She joined us there to talk about the state of tobacco usage in 2016 and what Wisconsin could be doing better. A group of UW students frustrated with diversity awareness and inclusion on the UW campuses have been trying to get a meeting with System President Ray Cross since last fall.
They've asked that the school address what they call a failure of progress on diversity and to fund programs to change it. They recently got the opportunity to sit down with the system president to talk about those demands.
Kenneth Cole is a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and leader of the UW Blackout Movement, and he joins us now in studio to talk about his experience. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
Well, you did end up getting this meeting with UW System President Ray Cross. Was that a surprise that this meeting happened?
You know, it was a little bit of a surprise, but I don't consider it too much of a surprise because we knew we were putting a lot of pressure on the university, and we knew that the university had either of two options. Either they were going to respond to us and give us what we wanted, or they were going to continue in negligence and receive more pressure. So we figured it was going to be either of the two. We just thought we were going to have to apply a little bit more pressure.
So you got this meeting. Overall, how did it go?
I would say the meeting went a lot better than I initially thought it would going in. You know, you have your perceptions about administration coming from the perspective of a minority student, a student of color. But we actually got a lot of things talked about and a lot of things hashed out. And President Cross was actually very, very accepting of the demands we put out and a lot of the initiatives and programs that we want to start here on campus.
Well, going into that meeting, what was at the very top of your list about things that you wanted to address and get to?
I think the first thing that we wanted to talk about was an issued statement of apology and recognition of failure of the university and the UW systems of just making this campus a more inclusive and diverse place that is a place that is beneficial and accepting of all colors and creeds. Something that we believe in is the Sankofa proverb of Africa, of ancient Africa, that says you have to know where you've been and you have to acknowledge that in order to get where you want to go. So we believe that it was very essential for us to recognize the problem before we try to start any solutions. If administration did not believe that there was a problem in the first place, then nothing would even be accomplished by trying to start initiatives.
Well, getting the administration to admit failure, that seems like a pretty big first step. So once you had that in hand, where did you want to go next?
After that, we wanted to look at programs like a cultural competency module, programs that aid in mental health for students of color here who deal with racial and social harm on campus, as well as creating, you know, a task force to continue to enhance and advance the programs that we and initiatives that we try to set out for this campus and for all 26 UW campuses.
And there was, I understand, a plan from 2008 that it sounds like it kind of languished and didn't get implemented. You want the university to update that. What do you want that to look like now?
So the thing about the 2008 plan is it sounded great. Like, it sounded amazing if you were a student of color and you read it and you looked at the principles that they put out, what they wanted to reflect and push in their agenda. It sounded amazing, but there was nothing really that was tangible or anything that we could take and take home and say, oh, we're going to get a Black Student Center, or we're going to get a cultural competency module in which there will be group discussions on why race, inclusion, and diversity need to be talked about and why they're important on campus. There was, you know, nothing like, oh, we're going to provide funds to student of color organizations and student of color programs for retention and recruitment. So we wanted to see more things that, you know, we could actually take home and say, oh, this is going to happen. And not just the university likes diversity or the university likes to talk about inclusion. You know, those are kind of the ways that that 2008 plan was framed.
So it sounds like you left on good footing. You're a senior this year. I assume you'll graduate this year. Do you have a sense of what you want the university to look like when it comes to diversity in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Well, what I really want the conversations to start being had. I don't want us to approach these topics lightly or to approach these topics without any regard to all perspectives. I know that it's a difficult, you know, concept, or it's a difficult thing for majority students to grasp that this is an actual issue for minority students. But I would like everybody to, you know, approach these concepts and for there to be, you know, just more support and backing from the university taking a stance on these issues, as well as those actual tangible resources that we were looking for.
Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Kenneth Cole, a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and leader of the UW Blackout Movement. He recently met with UW System President Ray Cross to talk about diversity and inclusion on campus.
New research on Disney princess films like The Little Mermaid, where the song's from, reveals something surprising. The male characters often speak more, sometimes way more, than the female characters.
And in movies that seem more progressive, with princesses characterized as spunky or strong, the men have an average of 3 times as many lines as women. The data comes from 2 linguists working on a project to analyze all the dialogue from the Disney princess movies.
One of those linguists is with us today to break down her research and talk about why it matters. Carmen Fott is a professor of linguistics at Pitzer College. Carmen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what led you and your colleague to tackle the Disney princess movies?
Well, you know, we were hearing a lot about the new princesses are more spunky, as you said, and more feisty, and there's so much better role models for our girls. But it just sort of seemed to be people's opinions, and we thought, well, we know you can learn a lot by studying people's language, so maybe we could study the language used in these movies and see if it's telling us something about how men and women talk and are talked about. And that's how we got the idea to just begin by counting the number of male and female characters, the number of words they speak, and kind of looking how those progress over time.
So tell us a little bit more about how you broke down those numbers and what you found.
Well, we got the scripts for the movies and we double-checked them against the movies, and then we counted all the words spoken by male or female characters. In terms of counting characters, we counted any character who had at least one spoken line or at least one line they sang by themselves in a song. Many people asked us, did we include animals? And yes, we did. We included anything that had a gender, teapots, reindeer, whatever had a male or female character. And we found, surprisingly, that despite the fact that these are called the princess movies and they seem to be targeted to little girls, and we think of them that way, in all the movies except Cinderella, there were more male characters than female. And in some of them, there were quite a lot more, many more characters that were male than female. But really, that's true for all the princess movies except Cinderella.
You split the movies into 3 categories, a classic, a Renaissance era, and a new age era. First of all, why did you break it up that way?
Well, chronologically, that's how it worked at Disney. There was the production of the first 3 movies, the classic movies, Snow White, Cinderella, and Sleeping Beauty. And then there's a period of 30 years before you get The Little Mermaid in 1989. So there's this big break where there weren't any movies. Then you get a bunch of movies in series, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Pocahontas, and Mulan in 1998. Then you don't get another movie until Princess and the Frog in 2009, so that's 10 years later, and then you get Princess and the Frog, Tangled, Brave, and Frozen, each a few years apart. So there's a big chronological space at Disney, and it also corresponded to some shifts in the corporation itself and the directors and producers and so forth.
Okay, so breaking it down like that, looking at those 3 eras, what did you find about who did the most talking?
Well, it's so interesting because in the oldest movies, the classic movies that we think of as the, you know, the really old-fashioned ones. Actually, the women and men talk about the same, or in some cases, the female characters talked more, which is not maybe too surprising for movies focused on princesses. Then when you get to the Renaissance era, the middle movies, starting with Little Mermaid, it completely flips around. In all of those movies, the men talk more than twice as much. So the women not only don't talk as much as the men, they don't even talk half as much. And in the one movie that has a male main character, in Aladdin, men talk 90% of the time. 90% of the words spoken in that movie are spoken by males. But even something like Pocahontas or Beauty and the Beast. In Pocahontas, 76% of the words are spoken by males. In Beauty and the Beast, it's 71%. So sometimes people will say, well, Aladdin doesn't count because it has a male main character. But that doesn't explain Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Pocahontas, or Mulan.
It's interesting that it's not just the Little Mermaid, because that story is sort of predicated on the fact that she loses her voice, even though she's present in the film. But it's also, you know, what you found in the subsequent movies, Pocahontas and Beauty and the Beast, all those, it's still true. So it's not just about the plot line, clearly.
That's right. That's right. And many people will say, well, what about Mulan? There are a lot of soldiers, you know. And someone commented on this and said, Mulan, you would expect men to talk more because it's in war and there's a lot of soldiers. So all the characters had to be men, except maybe Mushu. Well, that was a very interesting comment because, of course, that's right. And if only that movie were exceptional, we could say, oh, it's just about the soldiers. But also the comment, except Mushu. Mushu is male, the little dragon. There's no reason why the dragon has to be male. I think we can all agree that dragons don't exist. I mean, I hope I'm not leaping to conclusions here that aren't in my data, but I think that dragons don't exist, so they don't inherently have a gender, male or female. So someone made the choice to make Mushu a male.
Talking to Carmen Fought, she's a professor of linguistics at Pitzer College, talking about research she's working on Disney princess movies, who talks, how they talk, what messages it sends about gender. So Carmen, given that we have these movies with female leads, something like Frozen with two female leads, and still men talk more, so what gives? Who's getting all these lines? Why are the main characters not accompanied by a cast of other female characters saying stuff?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One answer is that when they went from the older classic movies to the Renaissance era movies, they added an enormous cast. There's a lot more characters generally. And the majority of the characters they added were male. So it's just interesting. I'm not the first person to notice this, but it's interesting to see that there's often you have a princess who's this central figure, and she's trying to find a husband or whatever. And she may be very important, but all the little people, so to speak, are men. You know, the person who lights the candles in the castle, the person who leads the horse across the road, the person who, you know, inspires the villagers to go get the beast. You know, all those other smaller roles seem to go to men by default. And that's, to me, that's not a good message to send little girls, that it's okay if they're the princess looking for a husband, but they can't have any of the other roles, the other jobs, the other, you know, they can't be the funny sidekick or whatever in the movie.
That's interesting, because it sounds like, from what I read, that Disney actually did sort of sit down and make a concerted effort to bring out scrappier female heroines who had more of a feminist angle to their stories. But then on the other hand, as you said, they didn't populate the worlds around them with very many women either. Was that just an oversight?
Yes, I couldn't have put it better myself. They brought out spunkier role models who are surrounded by a world populated by men. And I, you know, people often ask me, do I think this is something Disney did deliberately? And I can't know because I wasn't in their office, but my guess would be no. I think we see this pattern across a lot of media where it's just easy as the default to put in a character who's male. But for example, we have this idea that sidekicks, comic sidekicks, are men because men somehow are better in that funny role than women. And it's these little things that cause there to be this big imbalance and cause the world of the princesses and the roles for women to be very narrow. I will say, in terms of Disney trying to have spunkier heroines, that in Brave, it is true that the women talk more. In Brave, female characters talk more. It's the only one of the newer movies since Little Mermaid where the women talk significantly more. So that's sort of interesting.
And this is all just part one of your research, how much they say, and I think the results are kind of surprising there. But also you're getting into what is said, and one thing you've done so far is look at how compliments are given. So what were you trying to figure out, and how did that change over time?
Well, you know, we know a lot about complements and communities of real people, so I thought it would be something interesting to study. And we know that in real communities, there's a difference in how people give complements that's associated with gender. So in many of the places where it's been studied, women both give and receive a lot more complements. Compliments also in our society tend to be on certain topics, of which the two most prominent ones are appearance and skill. So you get complimented on how you look or on something you can do. And women receive a disproportionate number of compliments on their appearance. Men receive very few compliments on their appearance in real societies. So we looked to see if this was true in the Disney movies as well. And that's where things get interesting in terms of the history of it. In the classic movies, women are much more likely to be complimented on their appearance. The princesses get told how beautiful they are a lot. In the Renaissance, that trend continues, although it's a little bit less large of a difference. They still get complimented a lot on their appearance, but now they're beginning to get complimented more on their skills as well. And finally, in the newest movies with Frozen and all the spunky heroines, it switches over. And in the newest movies, women receive only 22% of the compliments they get on their appearance, but 40% are on their skills. So in my world, in my view, that represents some progress.
So obviously the last thing, the complimenting, represents a flip-flop.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at our Facebook page and some comment threads after some articles about this, that people are also saying, you know, what does it matter how much somebody talks? I mean, it doesn't necessarily correlate to how much power they have, but would you disagree with that? Does power equal verbal presence?
No, I think that's a completely fair way to put it. I don't think it's everything to say how much people talk, and I do think power can correlate to other things, and we're looking at quite a few of those things. So we're looking at directives, for example, which is the linguistic term for commands, how much people order other people around. So we're going to add a lot of things to address power, but that doesn't make the fact that the men talk so much more unimportant, because as I said, it still correlates to this idea that sure, you can be the princess and you can have a lot of power and everything, but all the other little roles that keep society functioning in these societies belong to men.
We're talking right now about Disney princess movies and the messages that they may be sending to children with Carmen Fott, a linguist who's analyzed the dialogue in these movies.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think when you hear about this research? Have you watched these Disney princess movies with your kids or grandkids? Were they a part of your childhood? What do you make of the messages they send or don't send? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about the dialogue in the Disney princess movies with Carmen Fott from Pitzer College.
Taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234 as we talk about who talks, men more than women in almost all the Disney movies. That's gotten more so over time, and how they talk, what they say. How do you think the dialogue in these movies affects children, their ideas about boys, girls, men, and women? How do you talk about these things with your kids, and do you watch these movies yourself with your kids? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to a caller now. We've got Carolina on the line with us from Green Bay. Hi, Carolina.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment is about some other cartoons. For example, I have a 4-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. And my daughter really liked to watch Strawberry Shortcake. And I figured, well, why not? It's a group of girls who are going on adventures together and all of that. But about a month ago, she started using some of the lines from this cartoons. And one day she said, oh, Mother, this is so embarrassing. They're going to make fun of me. And I realized that this was not coming from something she heard at home. And her brother told her, stop saying bad things about yourself. It's from all those videos you're watching. So since then, we've really started to not watch those videos and instead just going to maybe books or something a little bit different because it is really affecting what she's been saying. And I'm glad that my 6-year-old son caught on to that.
Right, yeah. Carolina, thank you for that. And I hear your kids chiming in the background there. What about that, Carmen? That's interesting. So she's saying even if sort of the plot line seems empowering, the messages, the actual dialogue sink in and have an impact.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, congratulations to her on having a son who's so aware of these things that he's trying to help his sister not absorb bad messages from the media. That's pretty impressive to me, I'll just say. And yes, you know, really what this is about, people will ask me, what's a good movie? What's a bad movie? It's not really like that. It's more the case that whatever your children choose to watch or whatever you choose to let them watch, you should be aware of what's in it, you should be conscious of it, and you should be available to talk with them and to say, oh no, you know, don't say that. That's something Strawberry Shortcake says, but it makes you feel bad about yourself. And I don't think girls need to say that kind of stuff. I think I'd rather say this, or however you want to put it with your kids.
Carolina, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Alan in Appleton. Alan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not commenting specifically on Disney movies, but I have seen shows, I don't have any kids, but family members that do, and there's one specific show, and I think it's called, the Young Einsteins or something like that. The beginning of the show, it's, two girls and two boys, and they're, go on these, they explore, do all this stuff. Well, in the beginning of the show, when they're playing the introduction, the girls have singing and dancing, that's their thing, and the boys have, the one's a conductor, and the other one plays an instrument. The boys, also one of the boys flies a plane. The girls are always taking the submissive roles, and in, one of the parts, one of the boys wears glasses, and one of the girls actually wipes his glasses off and hands them to him.
Hmm. Alan, thanks a lot for the call. It sounds interesting. So what we see them doing, I know you're a linguist, should we be watching what they're doing, the roles they're playing, Carmen?
Oh, absolutely. The language and the roles they're playing all work together. And this is a fabulous example of something I was going to say earlier, which is the thing that's dangerous about this is that it goes below our radar. If I go out and ask who speaks more in the princess movies, men or women, to someone on the street, they're going to say women because they're the princess movies. But even if they've seen all the movies, because it just passes under our radar. This is similar. The girl wiping the boy's glasses is the type of thing we might not notice, but we can train ourselves to notice. We can pay more attention and catch these things and talk to our kids about them.
I was thinking about the one particular movie you said really sort of bucked all of these trends and had a strong female cast with a lot of dialogue, was Brave.
Yes.
And I was looking back and I don't remember that being a huge Disney hit. And that could have been to do with the plot. I mean, it was moderately successful, I think. But I wonder if audiences want to see this, if some ways Disney is writing what Disney wants to write, or if Disney is writing what they think people want to see.
Well, there's a lot of things that are successful that, as you said, buck trends and aren't necessarily the thing that we're expecting. It's so hard to predict what audiences want to see, or else every movie that was made would win the Academy Awards and be a tremendous success. So I think by pushing to be a little bit outside the box, they're going to be able to draw in audiences. There were some other technical things with Brave in terms of the production that I think caused some difficulties in that movie. It's maybe too much to get into here, but I think there are other reasons besides the changing gender roles that caused some problems for that movie.
We're talking about Disney princess movies, the messages they send, who's talking, men or women, what they're saying to each other. Carmen Fott is with us. She's a linguist from Pitzer College. She's been doing research on this. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Sarah on the line in Milwaukee. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think this is a really interesting conversation. The point about motion movies, I think almost all of the animal companions that I can think of that accompany the primary characters in Disney movies tend to be male, and some speak and some don't, but that definitely conveys a message as well.
Sarah, thanks for that call. So those wacky sidekicks, usually animals, always, as you mentioned earlier, Carmen, men, whether they talk or not, that sends a message, Sarah says.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And she's right, whether they talk or not, because the rug in Aladdin, which we didn't count because it doesn't speak, I said it was male, but then I wasn't 100% sure, and one of my students went and checked, and sure enough, they referred to the rug as little guy at some point.
Well, what do you make of that? Why are all the fast-talking sidekicks the men? Is this sort of an overlap about ideas about women being funny?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Women comedians have had a much shorter history and a lot less success than male comedians because the idea is that women just aren't that funny and they don't take a joke and so forth. It's a stereotype that we have. Well, if you've ever seen Margaret Cho, she's absolutely hilarious. But, you know, we have to work against these stereotypes and the idea that just that it's easier to just by default put in a man. It's the men, particularly white middle-class men, are the default in our society. And so the only way to combat that is to be really conscious of it and make an effort to put women in new roles. Then you get the element of surprise, too. If they're not expecting a woman in that role, that will get people's attention. And in terms of media, that's good as well.
I guess the one exception is Mrs. Potts, right? But she's kind of this matronly tea kettle. She's not exactly funny.
Well, and it's not a coincidence that she's played by a very famous actress, Angela Lansbury, who was really big at the time that Beauty and the Beast was on. I think it was around the time Murder, She Wrote was on. So when you do get an exception to the rule, sometimes it is because there's a really famous person playing that role.
Back to our callers now with Julianne in Viroqua. Julianne, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to thank your guests for making these topics an issue with people because I think they're really important. I grew up with a mother who wouldn't let us see Disney movies. She thought that they were sexist and racist, and she wouldn't let my sister, who was named Barbie, have a Barbie doll. This was in the 60s. And she was so far out, you know, way out there, but she stuck to it. And I grew up being aware of, you know, women's issues and other kinds of issues that I don't think I would have been otherwise. And I think people just have much too much complacency when it comes to these topics.
Julianne, thanks for that call. So, Carmen, from what you were saying earlier, I don't know if you say don't watch the Disney movies, but you are saying watch and discuss.
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. And, I mean, kudos to the caller and her mother for getting those topics out there. I think it's the lack of awareness and the lack of our being aware of things that are sexist and racist that's really the problem here. I think if you want to watch a Disney movie with your kids, the way to do that is in a context of talking about it. But I think also there's a lot to choose from out there, and it's okay to look around. It's okay to not just let your kid have what every other kid is doing and think, are there better role models for my kid? Are there things she can watch or he can watch on the TV that present a model of what it's like to be a little girl or a little boy that I think is better?
Julianne, thanks a lot for that. And we'll take one more quick call from Rachel in Milwaukee. Hi, Rachel.
Oh, looks like we lost Rachel, but she'd said our producer let us know that she grew up not wanting to have the dark hair that she had because of the images of princesses in movies. So, Carmen, some people might say, oh, Disney princess movies dismiss it as a minor topic, but Rachel and others we've heard from say, no, this actually affected the way they grew up.
Yes. No, it's not a minor topic. These movies are widespread. They're marketed everywhere. With new technology, you can watch them on a little screen in the car. Your kids can be watching them in the back seat while you're driving somewhere. I wouldn't be surprised if kids on canoes in Brazil have little DVD players where they're watching Disney movies. It's very widespread. And there's research by psychologists showing that kids do use Disney in their play, and it does affect the way they think about things. And, you know, you can say it's a small thing, but it really isn't. It's something that's affecting how our kids see their own identities, their gender and ethnic identities. And I think that's huge. I think we need to know what's out there.
And Carmen, just briefly as we wrap up here, what are you going to look at next in this theme?
Well, we've already started on some other factors for the Disney princesses. So talking about power, which someone had brought up earlier, we're looking at directives, we're looking at insults, we're looking at apologies, speech acts that are associated with power or powerlessness. And in addition, we're looking at Pixar now, the Pixar movies like Toy Story and so forth. Mm-hmm. Boy, you want to talk about a cast that doesn't have a lot of females. So that should be interesting when it comes out, too.
Well, Carmen, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That was Carmen Fott, professor of linguistics at Pitzer College, and she joined us to talk about her new research about the dialogue in Disney princess movies.